to Bruderhof Radio, a bi-monthly program broadening the bounds of discourse on progressive thought and action. I'm your host, Andrew Zimmerman.
19,000 children are dying every single day in indebted countries because their governments are not able to spend money on immunization, on clean water, on food security.
This week on Bruderhof Radio, a look at third world debt and the movement for its cancellation. The poorest nations in the world, at least 50 countries by most counts, are so heavily in debt that they spend more on debt repayments than on food, medicine, and clothing for their people. As these heavily indebted countries struggle to keep up with debt repayments, they are forced by international financial institutions to divert even more money to debt repayments by reducing public sector jobs and focusing on the production of exportable cash crops rather than food crops. The harsh terms of debt repayment programs drive millions of people to poverty and starvation. Because international financial institutions are controlled by industrialized Western nations, there is a fundamental injustice of the poor paying the rich, and this is why there is a growing worldwide movement calling for the cancellation of the debts owed by underdeveloped nations. Jamie Drummond is a spokesperson for Jubilee 2000, a London-based group that calls for the cancellation of the third world's unpayable debt.
There are, in our view, about 52 countries, the poorest countries in the world, who are currently spending far more repaying debts to the richest nations than they do providing basic health care and education for their people. And these are, remember, the poorest people on the planet, those living on less than a dollar a day. So there's a fundamental injustice that the poor are paying the rich. Now, how did this come about? There's a number of sources for these debts. One of the main ones was that shortly after independence, because these are many of them former colonies of the Western empires, they borrowed money on grandiose projects, and some of these were ill-advised. Some of the money was well spent, but the point is that the money was also, besides being not always productively spent, it was often very poorly lent. And this is a very important point. Many of those who criticize our campaign say, well, these guys borrowed the money. You know, they've got to pay it back. That's the name of the game. Well, actually, and a very important part of the game, which any sane banker these days recognizes, is that you've got to lend money responsibly. Compounded with some kind of poor projects, unproductive projects, was the geopolitics that came through the Cold War, when many of the tensions between the Soviets and the Western allies were played out in proxy wars throughout, especially Africa and Asia and South America and Central America. And in that process, both East and West lent money, again, not for any, not to help the people of those countries so much as to prop up their strategic allies during the Cold War in order to play out the superpower politics. The point is that these dictators, in many cases, were lent this money, and it was not done, of course, in consultation with the people of those countries. But now, after the end of the Cold War, those countries are having to repay debts on money we lent them in order to win our war, not theirs, our war. And the point is, we when I say we, America and the Western European countries technically won that war, and the Soviet Empire lost. The point is, however, the real losers were the people who lived in those countries, who have suffered tremendous conflicts over the last decades, and found themselves really at the mercy of these kind of geopolitical considerations. They now have to repay these debts, and while at the same time trying to rebuild their economies and their livelihoods after devastation, after decades of these civil wars inspired by the Cold War.
Most of the money owed by poor nations is owed to two large multilateral corporations, the International Monetary Fund, or IMF, and the World Bank. These two institutions were created at the end of the Second World War to help maintain international economic stability. The primary function of the World Bank is to lend money to poor countries to promote their economic growth, while the IMF acts as a monitor of the world's currencies by maintaining an orderly system of payments between countries. While all countries have a membership in the IMF and the World Bank, the primary shareholders are the industrialized nations of the West, and it is these nations that set the policy of the IMF and the World Bank. When impoverished nations fall behind on debt payments, the IMF restructures their economies in an attempt to help them repay their debt. The primary restructuring mechanism is called a Structural Adjustment Program, or SAP. Jamie Drummond says that either by accident or design, structural adjustment programs provide an inroad for Western corporations all too eager for cheap labor and new markets in underdeveloped economies.
What happens is the debt becomes the lever by which these countries, in order to qualify for debt cancellation or renewed loans, they have to go through years of so-called structural adjustment programs, which are a menu of different conditions that these countries have to fulfill to get their debts cancelled and to get new loans. And many would agree that these countries' economies and the way they are run need some kind of reform, pro-democratic, pro-poor, and more environmentally considerate reform. And in many cases, they could be more open to some form of market forces. But what happens with the current structural adjustment program is that there is a kind of orthodoxy, a one-size-fits-all model economic program, which is imposed willy-nilly upon a very diverse range of countries in the Southern Hemisphere especially, and to in many cases, the net effects of these structural adjustment programs are not just worse for the poorest people within those countries, but they actually don't achieve their explicit goal, which is improved economic growth. They don't actually work from the fundamental tests they set themselves. Per capita GDP, per capita growth, economic growth in these countries has actually gone down since structural adjustment programs have been imposed. And that's partly because they are imposed in a very undemocratic fashion. And that gets to the heart of the nature of the IMF and the World Bank. They are undemocratic and unaccountable institutions who, it could be claimed, the sole purpose is to open up these countries' economies to international capital without accountability to the people in those countries or anywhere for the sake of a reckless profit. Now, Jubilee 2000 doesn't entirely align itself with those who completely want to abolish the IMF. There are important roles in international regulation and international finance that must be fulfilled by some organization. The question is whom and to whom is it accountable? And at the moment, the IMF is, in my view, in our view, inciting this backlash against globalization, because it is itself, though it preaches market forces, it is itself more like a kind of Soviet-style bank. It's completely unaccountable. The decisions are quite made in quite an untransparent fashion. And insofar as one can find out what's going on, it is very explicitly actions in the interests of the richest nations and not in the interests of the poorest nations.
Soren Ambrose is a policy analyst at the 50 Years is Enough Network, a Washington, D.C.-based group that also seeks to end third-world debt. Ambrose says that not only do structural adjustment programs often fail to reduce debt, they also have disastrous results from a humanitarian viewpoint.
Debt is a problem for two main reasons. The first is the diversion of resources involved for countries that are in severe debt problems, countries that end up having to pay something like 50% of their net export revenues towards payments of debt are obviously not directing those resources to where it's most needed. And, of course, these countries are the most impoverished, so their people are most in need of education, health, food, water, that sort of thing. And their governments are not able to provide it. But even more important than that, and that's plenty important, is the problem of the programs that the countries are required to adhere to in order to get loans that will supposedly keep the capital flowing so that despite their debt problems. That is to say, when a country gets in debt, it can't get capital from any other source other than international financial institutions. In order to get it from them, they have to agree to what are called structural adjustment programs. And it's our analysis and the analysis of a lot of people in the countries that have endured these programs for the last 20 years that they have actually caused poverty rather than alleviated it and have deepened debt problems rather than getting countries out of their debt crises. So these structural adjustment programs, which call for things like privatization, cuts in government spending, layoffs of public sector employees, reorientation of economies towards export production, meaning growing cash crops rather than food crops for the people, and building sweatshops to provide cheap labor, and hiking interest rates so that it's harder for people to get access to credit for their businesses or small farms. Those policies have meant real trouble for a lot of people and have literally meant death for hundreds of thousands, maybe even millions of people over the 20 years that they've been instituted in over 90 countries. And it's a function of debt. If debt were not there as a lever, countries would not have to agree to these programs. And it's our analysis that, in fact, these structural adjustment programs, which are geared towards a capitalist economy, one that opens doors for multinational corporations into other countries, is the real agenda of the World Bank and the IMF, that there's not a lot of incentive for them to solve the debt crisis. In fact, they want to use debt or whatever other bargaining chips they have in order to make sure that countries continue on the line of structural adjustment programs or whatever they happen to be calling them this year.
Jyoti Jehu is the executive director of the 50 Years is Enough Network. She says the IMF is a tool of Western capitalists looking to promote their own interests while ignoring the dire needs of people in poor nations.
We believe that the mission of development and eradicating poverty is a noble one, but we believe that the development model and the economic model that has been followed has really been the problem, that it hasn't been really been about development or poverty eradication, but about finding markets and finding investments for foreign companies, for Western companies. And so that's why you see policies like structural adjustment programs being promoted, which promote privatization and free trade zones or removal of tariff barriers that allow foreign corporations to do business in countries of the global south. We believe that if in doing projects and in promoting development, there was accountability, there was transparency, there was participation by the people, by the so-called intended beneficiaries of these projects, that we would see something changing profoundly.
But the International Monetary Fund is a private decision-making body, and most ordinary citizens of both rich and poor countries have no control over its actions. While many people call for full debt cancellation for the world's poorest countries, the IMF has responded with a program called the Heavily Indebted Poor Countries Initiative. Known by its initials, HIPC, the program was started in 1996 as an attempt to alleviate the debt of the 40 poorest nations in the world. While the IMF touts HIPC as an example of its largesse, both Jubilee 2000 and the 50 Years is Enough Network are critical of HIPC, saying that in most cases it provides only marginal debt relief, and that in some cases it drives countries even further into debt.
What happens is you have to do two things. You have to be poor enough, you have to be indebted enough, and you have to be vulnerable enough, i.e. you have to have a fairly limited capacity to earn foreign exchange in order to repay debts, so that economists call you an unsustainable economy in terms of you have an unsustainable debt burden. If you satisfy those criteria, you then have to go through a 3 to 6 year economic program, the structural adjustment program. And then at the end of all of this, you may or may not qualify for some debt cancellation. At the end of this entire process, we found that these countries will on average only get about a third of their debts cancelled, which is still leaving these countries with debts, annual debt repayments greater than the annual amount of money they can spend on healthcare. So on that criteria, we don't think the HIPC initiative is working even for the best performers, the best runners. But the kind of analogy can go further there, because the HIPC initiative is rather like asking the very poorest and most vulnerable people, unwell, unhealthy people, say, who've lost a limb, or something to run 100 meters in record time in order to qualify for the medicine to make them better. It's kind of, if you get the metaphor, it's putting the cart before the horse. These countries need the medicine up front, and then they might be better able to help their people, but become better functioning economies. And it's besides the economics, there's a political consideration there. There's a kind of political naivety, in fact, in the way that the international institutions try and impose this one size fits all economic medicine upon the poorest countries.
Soren Ambrose says that increased pressure on the IMF by his group and others has caused them to recently announce further enhancements to HIPC. But again, he is unimpressed.
The enhancements that they've announced both last year and now at the Prague meetings this year have been incremental. They mean that countries may not have to adhere to as many years of structural adjustment before starting to receive benefits. But in fact, what happens is that in order to get their debt fully relieved, the debt that the IMF and the World Bank promised to relieve, which is actually a pretty small portion of the debt, they have to continue to adhere to IMF policies because the debt relief is phased in over a number of years. So if a country were to all of a sudden stop following the kinds of programs the IMF likes, it would be very easy for them to withdraw the debt relief benefits that they had promised to the country. So in sum, we really think that the heavily indebted poor countries initiative, however enhanced it may become, which is a joint IMF World Bank program, is a smokescreen. It's a way of trying to coerce countries into continuing to follow the structural adjustment line when they don't have many other incentives to do so, with this promise of debt relief, which is in the final result often not very substantial at all. So it's a bribe for government officials to sell out their countries, and it's a very unfortunate situation that they've chosen to go the route of public relations rather than genuine debt cancellation.
You're listening to Bruderhof Radio, a bi-monthly program dedicated to broadening the bounds of discourse on progressive thought and action. If you've got questions or comments about today's program, give us a call at 1-800-778-8461 or visit us on the web at www.freespeech.org/Bruderhof. When speaking of debt, it is important to remember that debt per se is not bad. If money is borrowed responsibly and lent responsibly, it can aid in the development of poor countries. But critics of the IMF and World Bank say the money was not lent responsibly, and thus need not be repaid. The IMF has countered with the argument that outright cancellation of debts would incur what economists call moral hazard. If, for example, you cancel one nation's debts, you increase the risk that other nations will refuse to repay, hoping for a cancellation of their debts. Jamie Drummond says this argument is flawed.
Sensible debt cancellation is normal practice for bankers, and it's something that happens domestically frequently when companies or individuals become insolvent. But when countries become insolvent, there's a kind of a mythology around that they have to keep repaying, even at the cost of their citizens' lives. And that myth has to be exploded, and that's part of what Jubilee 1000 aims to do. We actually call for a more fair and transparent international arbitration process so that the issues of moral hazard are actually dealt with directly, because there are two types of moral hazard, to use this economist's term. One where the money is lent irresponsibly, and the other where it's spent irresponsibly. And you've got to get the balance between creditors and debtors right. So that would be our point about making sure that the international financial system can work for everyone if it occurs in a more just and democratic fashion. This is the great absurdity of it all. The IMF is supposed to be this this great public good serving the international community. But it's in fact a kind of an unaccountable technocratic elite who, because they're not actually subject to the proper scrutiny and discipline they should be, and that we would expect of, say, an American or British Treasury Department, they actually perform very sloppily, and they become intellectually quite incoherent, as well as imposing policies which actually don't achieve the objectives they set out to achieve, which is such as economic growth.
The Jubilee 2000 organization takes its name from the Jewish custom of a year of Jubilee, which occurs every 50 years, during which slaves are to be set free and all debts are to be forgiven. In the 50-plus years since the end of the Second World War, Jokey Jehu says, even though many poor nations have gone deep into debt monetarily, they have more than repaid those debts with cultural, environmental, and even human collateral, and that is reason enough to cancel their monetary debts now.
We have called long before debt cancellation became sort of a fashionable campaign to be part of or to be involved in. We've called for 100% debt cancellation on a number of grounds, one of which being that a lot of these loans were given to dictators. Everybody right now is talking about, you know, bad lending practices and, you know, corruption and all of that. When money was being loaned to Mobutu and to Marcos, they were corrupt. When the Duvaliers in Haiti and Somoza in Nicaragua and Moy in Kenya and all of these other dictators were given money, everybody knew that they were corrupt. But at that time, there was an agreement to turn a blind eye to them because of Cold War politics or whatever. We are not saying, you know, give them a free ride. Let them get this, you know, check and, you know, no strings attached. But what we are saying is that you can't, these institutions can't raise the question of corruption right now and use it as the new stumbling block to do what is right and what is morally just. When we call for debt cancellation, we are saying let the debts be cancelled because ordinary people are the ones who continue to be punished. It's not the corrupt borrowers. It's not the dictators who suffer because there are no schools or there are no books in schools or there's no medicine in the hospitals. They send their kids overseas for education. They send their, when they get sick, you know, a lot of them come to the United States or go to the United Kingdom for treatment. We are saying let the benefits get to ordinary people. Let them dictate, decide what are their priorities, what are their needs. We believe that debts should be cancelled because there was irresponsible lending in the past. And right now, only the bad borrowers are being held accountable. The bad lenders are not being held accountable. If you worked at a bank and you did the kind of lending that the World Bank and the IMF have been doing, not only would you lose your job, but you would probably end up in jail for the corruption. And the other thing is that these institutions, especially the World Bank, has admitted that a large number of their projects for which they loaned money were total failures on economic terms. And they say economic terms because only, and we look at economic, we look at social terms, we look at cultural terms where communities and cultures have been destroyed, we look at environmental terms. They have been massive, massive failures. And we say because of that failure, for lending that has failed on all these levels, the debts should not have to be paid. We also think that the debts have been paid in many ways. And in fact, our position right now is to demand not only accountability from the institutions and the people who made these loans, but to demand that the governments, the multilateral lenders and the bilateral lenders pay reparations to borrowing countries, to indebted countries, for all the things that have gone into the cycle of indebtedness, from colonialism to imperialism to neocolonialism, and in the case of African countries, going all the way back to slavery. All of that has been part of the of a debt that is owed to those countries versus them owing the creditor governments and the multilateral institutions.
While the debt crisis is often discussed as an economic issue, it is actually an issue of human rights and human dignity. Jokey Jehu works to promote this interpretation and says that in order to move people to action and to effect lasting change, the debt crisis must be presented in terms of human lives, not dollars.
The United Nations has said that 19,000 children are dying every single day in indebted countries because their governments are not able to spend money on immunization, on clean water, on food security, basic food security, and all these other things. 19,000 children are dying every single day. I mean, that is genocide. I mean, we sit here and everybody talks about what happened in World War II, what happened in Bosnia, what happened in Rwanda, and say never again. But actually, it's happening again, and it is time for people to say enough is enough. These deaths are too much. The price is too high in terms of human life, in terms of environmental costs, as countries are forced to engage in environmental destruction of epic proportions as they mine their resources and cut down their forests and vacuum their fisheries in an attempt to be able to service the debt. Enough is enough. The cost is too high. And somebody has to say at some point, stop. This has to stop right now. And I think that that's where we have reached. Saying not only do we need to stop paying, do countries in the global south need to stop paying and servicing this debt, countries in the global north need to say we are not taking another dime. And this, by the way, is not so radical a proposal. I believe it was a proposal that was put forward in Prague by none other than the finance minister of Canada. So we are not talking about very, very radical positions here. We are talking about humane and responsible and morally just positions that reasonable people can agree on without saying that, you know, these debts have to be paid. We are saying they have been paid, and the cost, the price of paying these debts for one single day more is just too much.
That's all for this edition of Bruderhof Radio. A look at third world debt and the movement for its cancellation. We heard from Jamie Drummond of Jubilee 2000 and Jokey Jehu and Soren Ambrose of the 50 Years is Enough Network. Jubilee 2000 can be reached at www.jubilee2000uk.org. The 50 Years is Enough Network is on the web at www.50years.org. This program was produced by Andrew Zimmerman. Bruderhof Radio is a production of the Bruderhof Communities, a Christian movement dedicated to nonviolence, communal living, and justice. Members pool their time and talents and share all goods and property in common. For more information about the Bruderhof Communities and Bruderhof Radio, call 1-800-778-8461. Again, that's 1-800-778-8461. Or visit our website at www.freespeech.org/Bruderhof.